So today's session is presented to you by the MBMA, and I made a mistake when I said the first time, the McGill Black Medical Association. And the purpose of the McGill Black Medical Association is to advocate for increased inclusion and success of minority students in the fields of medicine, dentistry, nursing, and other healthcare professions. The session will be moderated by Marcel Edwards and Lydia Vizina, who are the president and vice president, respectively, of the McGill Black Medical Association. I'll now pass it over to Marcel. Thank you. Oh, and I forgot to say, the session is English to French, so if you need translation, just outside, you can get a headset, and that should be awesome. Questions, concerns? Awesome. Okay.
So I thank everyone for attending first the conference and the symposium. It's our endeavor to try and make this symposium an enriching and stimulating one for you. I thank the panelists, Dr. Piggott, Ms. Piggott, Dr. Anderman, and Dr. Ferdinand for investing their time with us today. I thank the SEED office for their tireless efforts to make this conference a reality, and most importantly, we thank you for taking your time to come today. To orient you with regard to the structure of this symposium, it'll be a panel format whereby the panelists will have the opportunity to present themselves and any information that they find pertinent with regard to their respective fields, and then there will be an open discussion period. You'll notice that you have been given cue cards whereby you can pose any questions that you would like on the cue cards. Immediately after the panelist introduction, we will collect these cue cards for those of you who would not like to pose questions openly and pose those questions on your behalf. If at any point in time you would like to make a question or pose a question, we do invite you to either of the two microphones. I'll draw your attention to them in both aisles and encourage you to please pose your question. Please keep in mind that all questions and comments are open and welcome. To start off with a brief introduction of our esteemed panelists. At the end, we have Dr. Glynne Piggott. Dr. Piggott began teaching at McGill University in 1973 and retired as full professor in 2010 when he was named Professor Emeritus. He has held visiting professorships in North America and Europe. He also served as Associate Dean of the Faculty of Arts from 1982 to 1986, as a member of the University Senate from 1997 to 2000, and on the Principal's Task Force on Diversity, Excellence, and Community Engagement. Outside of the university, Dr. Piggott has served as a member of scholarship committees for the Quebec Black Medical Association and the Supercuts Foundation. Directly to his right, there is Mrs. Piggott. Mrs. Sylvia Piggott is president of the Montreal Children's Hospital Auxiliary, where she works to ensure sustainability of the services offered by the hospital. Amongst her other interests, Mrs. Piggott is chair of the Black Academic Scholarship Foundation, which raises funds to offer scholarships to university and trade school students. Mrs. Piggott also acts as a mentor to visible minority students in all disciplines. She has been awarded a number of prestigious grants and fellowships and has been named to a number of positions through which she contributed to the Digital Information in Africa program.
Dr. Anne Anderman is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Medicine, McGill University, and serves in the Public Health Department, Cree Board of Health and Social Services, James Bay and St. Mary's Hospital Family Medicine Center. In her research at Oxford and Princeton Universities, Universidad Federal de Bahia, and for the Quebec Health Technology Assessment Agency, Dr. Anderman has focused on health risks for women and children, universal access, risk communication and informed choice, research capacity in developing countries, and genetic screening policymaking. Dr. Ferdinand is a staff pediatrician at the Montreal Children's Hospital and an assistant professor, Faculty of Medicine, McGill University. She is also the coordinator of the McGill Social Pediatrics Program and the Short Stay Unit.
Further, Dr. Ferdinand is a staff pediatrician at the Bradshaw Youth and Family Health Center and sits on the Faculty of Medicine's Admissions Office Widening Participation Committee. Dr. Ferdinand's interests include social pediatrics, child maltreatment and child welfare, acute pediatric care, and infant mental health.
So we'd like to invite the panelists to introduce themselves any further and to discuss any aspects of their respective fields. Please. Dr. Piggott.
Thank you very much, Marcel and Lydia. I'm sure that when Marcel and Lydia invited me to participate, I think they recognized that I'm not a specialist in medicine nor in science. I actually am very much a layman when it comes to the field of science and medicine, but I have a passionate interest in education. As you know, I've been as Marcel pointed out, I've been associated with McGill for some 38 years as an educator. I served as an associate dean in the 1980s. One of the things I encountered back then, and it's still so now, is this idea of a set of stereotypes that we have to overcome as blacks. The view that you're great athletes, good caregivers. I still remember one incident in the Faculty of Arts when I was associate dean, when the janitor asked me to go find a broom for him, the janitor. And I was in the corridor. He thought I was the janitor. So we have this image that we have to overcome. And I'm part of an organization that saw the need to actually encourage young people to pursue careers in medicine and science. The Quebec Black Medical Association was founded a number of years ago, almost two decades ago, by Ellery Tucker. And I was happy to join Ellery. And over the past two decades, we have awarded some 200, we've made over more than 200 awards, specifically targeting people who are interested in medicine or health-related sciences. The idea is that we could empower people to actually participate in these key areas, which would advance not only the health of the community by providing, for example, opportunities or role models, for example, for the youth in the black community, but more importantly, it would also contribute to the overall education of the practitioners of medicine by participating with relatively diverse community, because the training that people tend to get when they focus only on small communities, narrow communities, tend to be quite limiting. If you include large groups of people, if you have to participate with blacks, with indigenous people, with other minorities, then you have a much greater understanding. In fact, you have a chance to demonstrate a level of excellence that you could not otherwise demonstrate if you're simply excluded a certain significant minority from your sphere of influence, your sphere of actually of knowledge. And I think that's why the principal invited me to participate in the task force on diversity, excellence, and community engagement, because she realized that, in fact, that McGill has to be a much more inclusive place. And it's to her credit that she recognized the need to actually introduce a set of initiatives that will reach out to communities and bring communities in actually to be not only receivers of knowledge, but to participate in the creation of that knowledge. So I think that this initiative that the principal of McGill has just initiated will create a culture change at McGill, and blacks have to be prepared to participate in that change. How so? Well, there will be an opportunity to reach out to minorities, to bring them into the community, to bring them into the community of scientists, of that they will be not only expected to come to McGill, welcome when they come to McGill, they have to achieve the same standards at McGill. There is a perception out there that, in fact, if you reach out to minorities to include a more diverse population, that somehow or other compromises excellence. Well, we have argued that, in fact, that it enhances excellence to have that opportunity, that diversity. And so, therefore, we're embarking on a new phase at McGill, partly as a result of the Principal's Initiative, which will invite minorities, including blacks, to feel welcome. Once they're here, they have to succeed. So the challenge before us, as educators, is going to be provide opportunities and support for minority blacks, minority aboriginals, other disadvantaged groups, when they get here, provide opportunities to help them to succeed. Now, one of the alienating things about McGill are the huge classrooms. And if you're not familiar with that sort of environment, if you don't feel at home, then you could easily be intimidated. So the challenge before Marcel and others like us is to find ways of easing the transition between the external world and these big institutions such as McGill. When students get here, we should be able to provide a welcoming environment for them so that when they're provided with opportunities to succeed, they will succeed because they have good role models and good mentors as well. So I think that the future will come in the form of creating an environment for mentoring and promoting what we think are opportunities for blacks to be good scientists and good medical practitioners. And that will be a real role models for the community.
Thank you, Dr. Piggott. Ms. Piggott?
Pardon me, I'm going to cede my position to the two doctors. I'll speak last. I'm community member, and I'd like to hear what the doctors have to say first, if that's all right.
Thank you for inviting me here today. So one of my big areas of interest has to do with health inequities. And health inequities has become a very important topic in the health world and also beyond. And I've had some involvement in this area in several different ways. So health inequities, what does this mean exactly? So a book was published about a decade ago with the title, Why Are Some People Healthy and Others Not? And this is not a problem that is specific to one country. It's really something that exists across countries, within countries, and also between countries. So just to give an example, if you look at an Aboriginal population in Australia, for instance, the Aboriginal population tends to live, on average, almost 18 years less than the native Australian population. In Canada, the statistics show that Aboriginal populations in Canada live, on average, about 10 years less than the Canadian population. And there was even a study done right here in Montreal by the Public Health Department of Montreal, which showed that people who are poor and less educated, living, let's say, in the east of Montreal more predominantly, lived on average 10 years less than people who are wealthier and more educated, living, let's say, more in the west and center of Montreal. So these inequities in health are pervasive. There's many, many examples, and many countries have taken this up as an important issue to tackle. In the UK, there have been many reports written on this, the Black Report being one of them. And this has also been an issue that's even been taken to higher levels in the international community. So the World Health Organization in 2005 put together a commission on the social determinants of health. And that commission was aiming to understand better these disparities in health, and also to take a look at, well, what is causing them. So the health inequities are generally underlied by social inequities that exist in communities, in populations. And it's indeed necessary, if we want to improve health of populations, that we have to also look at these social determinants of health and what can we do to act on those. And these social determinants include, so the Public Health Agency of Canada has put together a list of the, let's say, 12 major social determinants of health. And so while it's important to have a very strong health system, and the health system in itself is an important determinant of health, there are many other things, such as income and education and social support, gender issues, so many different things that have to be thought of if we're really looking to improve the health of populations. And I know at McGill it's a very high quality and famous university, started by the Faculty of Medicine, and now an excellent university and very diversified with many different fields of study. But one thing is, it still produces predominantly specialists, and it doesn't produce very many people who go into primary health care or who go into public health. And one of the reasons that I was particularly interested in those two fields, even though they're not traditionally as well paid, not traditionally as high status, shall we say, but these are the two fields, public health and primary health care, which really have their main focus as being issues of social justice, being concerned with issues of families, of communities. And I find that this is very important. So when I was working at the World Health Organization, at the same time as the WHO Commission on Social Determinants was releasing their report called Closing the Gap in a Generation, so an inspirational report, what can we do to close this gap between populations within countries and between countries, which is a whole other problem that also needs to be addressed in a global health context. We also had published a report, which was the World Health Organization has a report annually, and the WHO report 2008 was on primary health care. And the goal of this was, how do we improve access to primary health care, universal access, and also improve the focus and the quality of primary health care. And I think that these two reports actually go very well together, because in some sense, to really tackle the social determinants, it has to be a systems-based effort. And you're looking at social protection mechanisms, so for instance, to do with pensions or tax transfers, and even social protection can be the healthcare system itself when you have universal access to healthcare. So when I was looking at, I was teaching at Princeton University in their Global Health and Health Policy program, and there were Black and Hispanic students, and they were very interested in looking at the issues of disparities in health for these populations in the U.S. It's a very big topic there, and the CDC and so forth has written a lot, has been published in the MMWR on these issues. And I think perhaps it's a more common discourse in the U.S., but I think it's still an important discourse in a global level and in all countries to be really thinking about this. You know, we have, even at St. Mary's, I'm chairing a committee on community-oriented primary care. And the idea is to help teach the residents and the medical students in family medicine to think beyond who appears at their doorstep, who enters the clinic, because we really have to take what is called a population health approach. We have to be responsible for the entire population that we serve, the entire community. What are their health needs? What are their health challenges? And what can we do about those health challenges beyond waiting for them to come to our doorstep and put on a Band-Aid? What can we do in terms of prevention and looking at the upstream determinants of health? So the real goals of the population health approach are not just to improve the health of the entire community, but how do we also reduce these gaps and these health inequities? So I think that I probably spent my 5 minutes, but this is one of the areas that I'm interested in exploring further.
Thank you, Dr. Enderman. Dr. Ferdinand?
Dr. Pickett and Dr. Enderman scooped my talk, so I'm just going to kind of add to both of their talks. The first part I wanted to talk a little bit was about mentorship.
And to start my talk about mentorship, I think Dr. Pigott has emphasized the importance of mentorship. I just wanted to talk a little bit about myself and the importance of mentorship in the journey towards where I am today. I grew up in LaSalle, so low-income Montreal, and I went to public schools throughout my education, elementary school and high school. I always loved working with children and enjoying time with children. I enjoyed helping people, and I enjoyed teaching from a very young age. When I was 10 years old, I decided I wanted to become a doctor. And I decided I wanted to become a pediatrician so that I could help children get better. And I also wanted to be a teacher. When I was 15 years old, I was a volunteer at the Montreal Children's Hospital. And there I met many people who helped encourage me along my journey. In particular, I'd like to mention two people. One was the head of the volunteer department, and she saw in me qualities that she felt would make an excellent child doctor. And I remember one word that stood out in her evaluation of me, and that was altruistic. And the second person was a pediatrician who was also a professor at McGill University, and he later on went on to become one of my most important mentors. Of course, I mentioned already that I went to public school throughout my education, and there were many people along the way that helped me. And I would like to mention two people who stand out in my memory. The first was my grade 7 math teacher, and he instilled in me a passion for mathematics. He also taught me how to play chess. He encouraged me to join the chess club. And at the end of our time together, he gave me a little wooden chess set, which I just cherished. And the second person was my grade 10 chemistry teacher. She took the periodic table, something that I was petrified of when I remember walking my first day into chemistry class, and the whole wall was just this large periodic table. And she took it in, and she made it seem like an art form. And again, she developed in me this passion for chemistry. So along the way, I developed the important fundamentals that are necessary to progress towards medicine or any health-related field. But I also connected with my community. My family was an excellent support system, my church, my high school, and the Montreal Children's Hospital. So in summary, I'd like to say that I view myself as an example of the old proverb about it takes a village to raise a child, because I really feel it's the community, my community, that has helped me reach the stage that I am. And as Dr. Pigott says, the value of mentorship is key for all of us, not just for the Black community, but for every single one of us to help us along our path. And I was going to talk a little bit about the social determinants of health, but I will not repeat Dr. Andaman's excellent synopsis. But I would like to mention one thing. There is a book. It's called The Social Determinants of Health, The Canadian Facts. It was published in May of last year, and it is available entirely online. All you have to do is Google The Social Determinants of Health, The Canadian Facts, and it pops up. It's short, it's only 60 pages, and it's very easy reading. And it reviews many of the determinants that Dr. Andaman has already talked about. So what can we do? Well, in terms of the social determinants of health and improving them, we can work towards changing public policy. So I'll just summarize very briefly for all of you out there who are even considering a career in the healthcare field or in other fields. Work hard, believe in yourself, tap into your community resources, and always remember, we're here at McGill to help.
Thank you, Dr. Hernan and Ms. Pia.
Is my microphone, you can hear me? Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank the McGill Black Medical Association for actually adding me to the panel. I'm not a doctor, a medical doctor, but I have been a volunteer in the children's hospital for a number of years, culminating in being president of the auxiliary, which raises money, and a good sum of money every year, for things that the hospital needs to function that is not in their budget or that the government is very slow in funding. Things as simple as clean mattresses for the children, an extra wheelchair, food at a price that disadvantaged mothers can afford when they come to the hospital, to the clinic. Sometimes they wait a good 4 or 5 hours just to see the doctor, and the children need to eat, and so do they. We look after those kinds of things. We also look after things like the native children that come in. We provide the lunches for them. So a whole variety of good deeds. I think that's really my calling in life, doing good deeds. What I'd like to say in response to this conference, though, is I am very, very pleased to see that you've organized this symposium, and that the black medical students at McGill are getting really involved in the life of the university. That is something that is absolutely crucial to success. It allows you to know what's going on. It helps you to make good connections, which can be used for jobs, for scholarships, etc. And just to know what's happening and where opportunities lie. One of the purpose of MBMA that I was really pleased to see is this advocacy role that it says to advocate for increased inclusion in the McGill community. I think this is an absolutely key role, one that must be pursued relentlessly. It should be monitored, it should be documented, and it should be reported on to the university administration and to the black community. I mean, we can have all these wonderful words on paper, but if it's not bringing any results, we need to know. And we need to know because you're involved personally, you can get the facts, and you can bring it, you can surface these facts, and then we are able to take action where action is needed. It looks like there is not, my caution to the group is, if it looks as though nothing is happening, it might just be a perception. Gather the facts. When you have the facts, you take that to the administration and you take it back to the community. But the key thing is, it's not just to go and whine about what's not happening. You go along with a solution, a possible solution. This is not happening. This is what you said would happen. It's not happening. These are the facts. Here are some ways we might move things along. So always have a possible solution. No one wants to hear a lot of, we always say no whining. Whining we will leave for the parties, but not for serious things. In terms of the community absolutely has a key role to play. The community needs to pay attention to the results that the MBMA advocacy reports. We need to take action on those results. In other words, the community has a responsibility to get involved and to support and encourage the MBMA in their efforts. But we won't know it if you don't tell us, kind of thing. Your social position, I think, is really important. You say it is our position that part of the empowerment of minority communities can come from within the community. I'd like to change can to must come from within the community. When there is increased representation, that again I find too weak. It's with increased representation and involvement. It's fine to be representative, but if you're not doing anything, you're really not involved. Some people get into things to get their name on the list or on the committee and to use it. It's not really helping the organization. They have to get involved. They have to be making a difference, and that's what you need to do. If they join and they aren't making a difference, then you replace them, kind of thing. The community role, then, we have to involve competent and motivated healthcare professionals from the black community. We need to seek them out, and we need to let them feel that they have some responsibility towards students like yourselves or to new professionals. A lot of us, like you say, needed that little extra hand-holding to move you along, or if you're heading off track, to pull you back on track. So that should be our role. I think just by the fact that you have this SEDI, is that how you call it? This organization is an indication that the future is beginning to look a bit brighter. Obviously, we must congratulate McGill, as Dr. Piggott said, in recognizing this and setting up this group. However, again, this, I'm always forgetting, QMBA, no. I'm like the person who was introducing me, I can't remember what it is. It is your MBMA must hold the university's feet to the fire to produce. It's fine to say we have this group and we've done our job and we have our task force and our reports and what have you, but if nothing is happening, you need to know and you need to go to them and say, here is what this says. Up to date, we have not seen either no improvement or enough improvement. But it's really your job to pay attention, to report what you see in a very organized and appropriate way, and then to make sure that things are moving in the direction that you expected to remove, and also in the direction that they promised. The university makes a promise to you, make sure they keep it. As I say, I'm not a doctor, but I'm certainly very interested in health. The older I get, the more I'm interested. I'm currently working with some committees for the new hospital. Wonderful project, very large, very expensive, as the press is happy to tell you very often. A lot of not so positive publicity around it. However, it is something that the city needs, that the province needs, that it's happening. I'm volunteering there. When you're called upon to volunteer, please say yes. There's lots and lots of work out there to be done that there is no money for, but it's crucial work, and it's also work that is detrimental to good health. If you cannot volunteer enough time while you're a student, that's understandable. Your number one priority is getting through your program. However, we're all busy, but we do have an extra hour which you can use to volunteer. Volunteerism has a lot of paybacks. It gets you known, it gets you connected in the right groups, it gets you jobs, it gets you scholarships. A lot of the scholarships we give out to people who volunteered in things that we've put on. We get to know them, we remind them that the scholarship application is coming up, fill it out, send it in on time, etc. If you're not involved, you don't know what's going on. So my final word to you is get involved. Even if it's for 1 hour, it is valuable to you and it's valuable to our community. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all the panelists, please. At this point in time, we will collect any cue cards that you might have filled out with questions. It will take approximately 2 to 3 minutes to do that, and thereafter we'll pose questions. Thank you. If you would like to pose questions directly as opposed to having questions on your cue card, I do encourage you to take one of the two mics that are in either aisle, and please feel free to pose those questions as cards are being collected. Thank you.
Hello. My name is Carmen Antoine, and I'm an alumni in engineering from McGill. So, why I was interested in coming into this for this discussion, because it was written here, pressing issues in the black community, and one that I thought was very important is, you know, when a black person go see a doctor, I'm talking in Montreal, in Quebec, what I realized that most of the doctors do have a perception of who is a black person. And therefore, how they help you, it's not the same as if it was somebody else. And I would just like to know, what do you think about that? Am I dreaming about it, or is that true? That, because for me, this is a pressing issue. When I go see a doctor, white, black, Hispanic, Vietnamese, I want this doctor to treat me as a person, not only as a black person. And I do feel, for my family, for my friends, that this is not happening.
I mean, I don't know if I can take responsibility, but I certainly think that while McGill is trying very hard to develop these qualities and important attributes for physicians of professionalism, of empathy, and also to consider Sir William Osler is a famous figure who used to teach at McGill, and, you know, he had very important messages about how a physician should treat their patients. There's actually an Osler Society for McGill medical students. And to look at the whole person and not just look at the person as an illness. But I think also what you're saying is beyond that, to look at the whole person and not look at them as, you know, what their country of origin might be, or what their language might be, and so on and so forth. And I think, I mean, while I cannot say for certain, but I think that some of these things might be reflective of just more pervasive things in society about how people view different groups. I work also with the Aboriginal communities in the north. I must say, from my personal experience, I recall, and I still see as a teacher, how diverse the student body is. I mean, the McGill medical student body is extremely diverse, and names you know, from all different parts of the world, and so it's definitely very diverse student body. I know that they try very hard to integrate teaching of professionalism and communication skills and so forth, but what you find out there in the world is not always what one would hope it to be. And I think, you know, these kinds of issues should certainly, you know, medicine should show an example. But I also think that these are sort of wider issues of how we view people from different cultures and different backgrounds and so forth, and how we just treat people in general. I think it's I think you raise a very important point, and we should be setting a better example.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And
let me just suggest, let me add something to it. This may have to do with the nature of medical education. Medical education focuses a lot on just simply diseases and taking care of people who are ill. There is a focus on the training from the very, very beginning. If you're a pre-med student, you take science courses. You take very few courses that actually open you to human beings in their larger context. They're not just sick people, they're human beings. There are very few opportunities to do cultural anthropology, to do sociology. The curriculum is so structured. When I remember having a conversation almost 20 years ago with the Associate Dean of Medicine, says, can't you find some room to open up the medical education so that there is a greater breadth to it? Well, there are limitations of time. That was the response, and the needs of the accreditation process that have to be met. Well, so that's part of the answer, I think. But I don't know whether or not they've made any progress in 20 years.
But can I say something? That I came with my friends, my family, and most of the community, because we know nurses, we know doctors, we know people. And what I realized as a black person, and I'm sorry to say that, but if you want to get the best of your healthcare system, first of all, you do not go alone to see a doctor. Credibility is that as if you go alone see a doctor, most of the time, there's no credibility. You're tough. No, you're not here. You cannot feel pain. This is how it's happening right now. And I must say that, yeah, probably I go to the Francophone side. I'm not going to say it's necessarily McGill, but it does happen. And what I would like to happen is, how do my sisters, my brothers, how can they get the best out of the healthcare system? So how, what are the strategies? The first one I found was, go with somebody, and if you can, let's have a white friend. It's going to be more credible. This is how it is happening. I'm sorry, but this is the reality. So I don't know, what do you, you are the expert. I'm just a citizen. I'm the other side of the counter. This is what I'm doing, but I don't think it should be like that. Because not all of us are educated. Not all of us know how to talk to a doctor who's not scared to talk to a doctor. Cultural background is still there. We view, most of us, black people from any Africa, Caribbean, they view the doctor as the next person after God. So how can we pass through that and get those citizens to be able to get the best out of the healthcare system? If you cannot answer, but now I understand, but I think it's something that we should push a little bit more. We should educate people toward that this is happening. So this is the only thing I wanted to say.
If I can say a couple of words, I think you've said the answer. The answer is education and advocacy, and bringing someone along with you who can advocate for you. And if I could just mention one of the strengths of the McGill program, we do have a physicianship program, and Dr. Anderman alluded to that. It's one of the signatures of our medical school, and we are way ahead of many other medical schools from that point of view. So I would hope that we will see it disseminating into the community and educating the rest of the community about the importance of treating everyone as an individual.
I'd like to add something as well. I think that this is a really good challenge for the MBMA group to take forward as an issue, as a weakness in the program. And it could also be tied into this SEDE program, where they need to provide courses on cultural sensitivity, etc., regardless of what accreditation needs it and all the rest of it. Because if the doctors have gone through the program, have their degrees and are out there practicing, and people are feeling ill-treated by them because of the way they approach them, etc., then it really doesn't matter that they have the degree. They're not helping. I think you, Marcel, and your group need to make sure that this is built into the program somehow by being relentless about saying, we are hearing this a lot, and it is detrimental to the health of our people, because if you're treated badly, you won't go again, or you'll have to be dying before you go, as opposed to going at a time when you can be helped, and helping you is cheaper at that stage than later on. So Marcel, the challenge is out there to you and Lydia and company.
I might just say another word after hearing the other comments. And, you know, I'm very happy to have come here today exactly to hear the kinds of comments that you've just made. And maybe on a positive note, in terms of the McGill curriculum, from time to time it does undergo radical changes. And so the physicianship program really is an excellent program. But one of the things that I was alluding to when I spoke earlier is that McGill undergraduate medical curriculum is lacking in the primary health care and in the public health content, and that has been noted, and they are planning to actually restructure the curriculum yet again. Of course, it does have to take into account what are the different objectives for medical education and the accreditation and so forth, but I think there's a great opportunity here, and I've actually been the person who's been asked to come on board to help put more public health and primary health care content into the curriculum. But I think of this with a very broad, in a very broad way, because I think medical students, they come in, as you say, from day one, and they start and they learn about molecules and cells and so forth. But they don't learn about communities and social determinants of health and what is health. And I think issues of cultural competency, which have been raised here today, is extremely important. And I think, you know, it's very effective to have people say, this is how I feel when I come into the doctor's office. And, you know, I mean, I know I don't treat my patients that way, but it makes me feel awful to know that people are being treated that way. Color or no color, I've heard recently a story about how someone else was told something that I find absolutely ridiculous, and how people just don't take the time to get to know why people feel this way, what's going on in their life, what is happening in their family, in their community, and so forth, and really look at the broader context of where people are coming from. They try to teach this in family medicine, but I know that it's not always possible to have the ideal or the homogeneity that you would hope for in addressing these issues. But certainly, I would be happy to take these kinds of comments and try to work them into our program, and find, I think, even people like you who would like to come and express, to the medical students, how it is on the other side of the doctor's office, how people feel and how important it is to have that sensitivity and to think about that, because I think that these things are important to educating and sensitizing students to these realities that we might not always be aware of. So thank you for bringing it up.
Can I just add one more? The physicianship program, there's been a lot of feedback from the students for the physicianship program. And the students seem to prefer to have people like you come and speak to them about what would make them a better physician, as opposed to someone like me who just stands there and gives a lecture. So I completely agree with you. I think it's an excellent
forum. So you are invited for August of 2012. We will schedule you in. But I do think it's important, and I think the cultural competency is something that has to be an ongoing learning process from the very beginning. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for a wonderful question and for the responses. I have a question here, please.
Hello? I need your advice to dealing with McGill politics and structure. I congratulate the medical faculty for being somewhat more sensitive to communities. I'm wondering whether we can spread that to the other faculty, because I'm having a problem with my particular faculty in engineering, one of the departments. So I can't speak to all the departments. My particular department was asked to build a medical ship in Nunavik for the Inuits, and I did the research, and there was people taken away in the 50s, maybe you know this, with tuberculosis, and their families never heard from them again. And I found this afterwards, and I said, let's do some research on the culture. And they said, no, we would want you to be Orientalist, meaning like an imperialist. Well, I said, well, being imperialist, being an Orientalist means you're ignoring the local culture community. And then they started calling me, having a white man's burden, calling me white. They said everybody should be equal, whether they're French and Chinese. The professor's looking at me. I'm like, okay, well, this is like my childhood in Quebec. You know, this is a bit too much for me. So I don't know what to do. So I decided I'm not going to file the harassment suit or to complain to the power structures. I did get taken away from the course. The graduate director helped me out. But they did not see any diversity issue here. Even though my department has half a woman, because she only has two classes, and everybody else, there's no other diversity in the program. So here I am, I'm supposed to, I don't know, take on my sort of white guard and play along. Why don't I see someone like her on the faculty in my department? Are you saying they're not qualified? And yet I'm supposed to be like, play along and have, you know, do my diversity thing, although I'm not trained and not do anything. So I'm really troubled by this. I'm wondering if, you know, I don't want to get anybody in trouble or my master's degree in trouble, but how do I get this to the principal that we need to sensitize the other faculties? And if you have any other suggestions, I'd be all ears. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone that would like to perhaps answer to that? Perhaps Dr. Pringett?
I'll try. Perhaps the principal's task force on diversity, excellence, and community engagement has produced a report. It's almost ready for public viewing. It should be before the Senate in a week or so. And then I think that the question of reaching out, sensitizing people to other communities, to engaging communities, to bringing more diversity into academic programs and diversity of all sorts, a diversity with respect to race, diversity with respect to culture, diversity with different points of view, a diversity of diversity in a range of ways, diversity of experience, to bring all of those things into the McGill environment will actually go a long way to sort of addressing some of the concerns you have. I don't think that going to the principal now will make much of a difference. She'll probably tell you, wait until you see what the report says, and hopefully we'll make a change. It will, I think, involve a real change in the culture at McGill in order for this outreach to communities, bringing more people in, to actually succeed. But I think it's, I think you should wait for the report and see. Yes.
Could I get a copy of that? I mean,
Well, it goes to Senate next week on the 16th, so it should be a public document at that point. Yeah. Everything that goes to the Senate.
Because my background is community civil rights. I just go to the meeting. I don't have time for this.
Well, you're
so that I'm trying to be patient, but this is really very unequal and very, you know.
How about the 16th? Today's the 12th. Okay. Over the weekend, no one does much, so give it 4 days. How about that?
But otherwise, it's not public yet. This white paper, this.
Not yet.
All right.
Okay. Good. Thank you. There's a question over here.
I just had one other word to add to this. Did you also want to say something? I just wanted, in response to your question, I just think from a public health standpoint, whenever you're producing a project or a program that aims to improve the health of a population, it is very important, I think, to use the knowledge that you have, the cultural knowledge that you have, in helping to develop that program. In fact, medical anthropologists have become highly valued members of the team. They're hired at the World Health Organization and so forth to make sure that programs and projects and policies actually work the way that they're intended to and take into consideration the cultural norms and specificities and so forth to ensure that they work. So I think that what you have proposed, from my personal opinion, and I think also my professional opinion, it's important to take into consideration these things. There might be other levels of politics involved, obviously, and one would help, to talk about this in an open way with your peers and your superiors, but if that's not working to your satisfaction, then I think also McGill has a zero tolerance for harassment. And I don't know if you can call this harassment, however, so this is a sort of tricky issue, that there are people that you can go talk to. There is the Dean of Students, there is the Ombudsperson. So I think that you have to use these channels, but I also think it's important to try to get these issues raised, but also not create too many problems for yourself in the process and so forth. Maybe the engineers are just focused on the mechanics of it and not thinking of these broader issues. It would be good if they worked in a more interdisciplinary way and considered cultural issues and cultural context, because ultimately the success of their project very much depends on that. But if they're not aware of that or wanting to look at that, there's challenges in that.
Great, thank you. Do you have a question, sir, right?
Okay. My question has to do with mentorship programs or ways of mentorship that includes minority population, but specifically those within the immigrant community. It's not a secret that a lot of Canada, a lot of Quebec especially, is, they just arrived here or the parents are immigrants, etc. So, we got a synopsis of your professions and your histories, but I don't know, I only from Dr. Ferdinand, I believe, did we get a kind of history of your childhood, do you guys have, are you, were you guys born here, or do you have family who that came here recently? I was wondering if you can each give us just a quick synopsis of your lives and what led you to your professions as such. I like, you know, I learn a lot from stories, as do a lot of people. And then maybe I'll have to talk to you later about this, but just give us any mentorship programs that are sensitive to the fact, like for me, for instance, you know, I come from a very mixed family, which I think is the case for most people. You know, I wasn't born here, but I came here as a child, and then half my family's here and been here for a long time, or born here, and the other half, you know, just came from Haiti. So it's a mixed situation. So I'm seriously considering a profession in the medical field, and I realize that mentorship is so important, but a lot of people in my situation don't get the full benefits of mentorship because they don't see somebody who came from that similar position. And that's why my white equivalent will benefit from that situation so much better than I. So you have to kind of look harder. But they're there. I'm just trying to get more information about that. So please just quickly a brief history of your lives and what led you to that, and then some mentorship opportunities available. Thanks a lot.
Before the brief history, perhaps we can make one quick comment. We're lucky to have with us today, actually, one of the individuals from the admissions office of the Faculty of Medicine, Mr. Bettine. And it's, I think, of importance to note that the faculty, and not just the faculty, but the entire institution has recognized that issues of mentorship, issues of inclusion, and issues of diversity with regard to healthcare are critical. Many of the panelists have spoken to that point today. In terms of mentorship and guidance in the application and the career building process, I can say that the Office of Admissions has taken a very strong position on this point, in recognition that there are certain minority groups, i.e. blacks, aboriginals, and individuals of rural origin, who perhaps have a strategic disadvantage, if you will, compared to some of the other applicants. And I strongly do invite you to be aware of the programs that are being made available through the Office of Admissions, and as well some of the initiatives that through the MBMA we're endeavoring to try and make available to students and individuals in the community. One small point in addition is that there happens to be a number of organizations that are in the community doing very good work. Dr. Piggott mentioned the Quebec Black Medical Association, which I strongly invite you to be aware of. And in general, I think to speak to the point in a broader note, part of the onus, unfortunately, does rest on the individual to make themselves aware of the organizations that are available. But I think that there has to be a stronger position from organizations and institutions like McGill to make that information available to everyone in a structured and systematic way. So I welcome your comments, and I think the panelists will be able to elaborate more to some of those points. Thank you. Perhaps would you like to start there, Dr. Piggott? We're going to try and keep it a little brief, so we can go on to some of the other
mentorship
questions.
I think, takes many forms. I think there's mentorship at a very early stage in your development, before you actually get into medical school or before you get into university. People have to be encouraged, people have to be motivated, people have to help to find their paths forward. So mentorship comes in the form of guiding people towards certain career paths. So you have to depend on people like your primary school teacher, your secondary school teachers, and some organizations like QBMA. We have this outreach program. We send people into the CJEPs, into the high schools, to talk to people about science, about getting into science, because science seems to have been an intimidating thing to a lot of people. Not because science itself is hard, it's because it's actually a myth about science being hard that people have to overcome. So part of it is getting good direction as to what paths you would find convenient and appropriate for you. But once you get into institutions, mentorship should continue. So this is where I think universities are not very good. They don't actually provide for good mentorship once people are in the institutions, especially from these communities, people from communities that are already feeling a bit marginalized, that they're really somehow uncomfortable in these large, in these institutions that, for which they, for some reason, feel they don't really belong. But when they get there, they're not, there's no welcoming, there's no. So what we hope that McGill and other institutions should establish, once people are here, create structures to help them find their way through. How to talk to professors, how to talk to even fellow students, how to seek out, for example, opportunities, for example, financial aid, things as simple as those things, the way to get you through the bureaucracy as well as the academic path. There are a number of models that exist right now that we could draw on, best practices elsewhere. But I don't think they're in place right now, but they're crucial. I think with respect to the immigrant experience, I'm one. You're looking at an immigrant right now. And I don't think that all immigrants have the same experience. But you're right about the fact that we could actually provide much more of a supportive environment for people from immigrant backgrounds if they were actually talking to people like us who went through that experience themselves.
Thank you. Perhaps a minute or two for Ms. Payet and Dr.
Well, just a very few words, really. I think the key is you have to get involved. I mean, if you're in the university, we don't know about you. But if you come out to things that we hold, that's when you get to know and meet people in various professions. We used to run a couple of years ago something called a Business Week for Visible Minorities. Marcel was involved in that too. We brought professionals out and invited the young people and students, etc., to come and meet them at different tables, the accountant, the doctor, the lawyer, the etc. And at that stage, all of the people that we invited to participate, all of the professionals, promised they would be mentors if asked. Mentor is something that is a little tricky. I know in the large corporations we have mentorships set up, which is where my background is. But again, it's a matter of the mentee has to go and ask the mentor because of a whole variety of things that can happen if the person in power is the one that goes and asks. And so we have to make the situation very comfortable for the junior person to go and ask the professional, would you be my mentor? My two daughters are out in the workforce. One of the things I said to them is, once you get the lay of the land in the organization, pick someone you would like to be your mentor and ask them. Just go up and ask them. They're very willing if you go and ask them. They're not willing to come and say, I'd like to mentor you. It's got sexual overtones. It's got all kinds of things that get people into trouble. So you have to really, in many cases, make the first move when it's a mentor in the community you're looking for. The university, of course, can set up mentoring program. But again, that has to be carefully run where, again, the person in power is not the one saying, I will do something for you. You go and ask. That is how we set it up in the corporate world for a whole variety of reasons. After a number of studies were done, when it was done the wrong way, it can be very devastating to the mentor and the mentee if things aren't handled very professionally.
And Dr. Edelman?
And so you're asking about the histories, and I agree. When I was looking at what career I wanted to follow, what path, I spoke to many people, generous people, who told me how did they get to be where they are, and I thought that was actually really helpful for me in choosing my path. And so I encourage you to continue asking people about their history. So I'll tell you a bit about our family history. So I'm a first-generation Canadian, so I was born here, but my parents and grandparents were not. not. They were born in Eastern Europe, what used to be the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and what now is Ukraine and Poland. My grandmother was born in a tiny little village that had an elementary school but no high school. So to go to high school, she had to move away from her family and live with distant relatives and business partner her father to actually go to high school, and then move away again to actually go to medical school, where she met my grandfather, who was also in medical school. And then the war hit, and my mother was born, and they were Jewish and hiding from the war. My father, who was in Romania at the time, had a different war experience because of the politics. But basically, they were hidden. Much of the family ended up in concentration camps and had died. After the war, they ended up in a DP camp and gradually then made their way to Canada because one of the brothers had already been in Canada before the war. When they arrived, they were, like many people continue to be today, the IMG experience, international medical graduate. They had graduated medical school. They had not finished their residency training because of the war. They had started, my grandmother wanted to be a pediatrician because she also loved children, and my grandfather wanted to be an internist, but because they had done just a little bit of psychiatry, that was what was open to them as Jews just before the war, they decided they would just continue on in that path and that would make it easier. They had a hard time. They had to travel to the prairies, the terrible winters, to get their training completed. They knew 8 languages before they moved to Canada, but not English, so they had to learn English, do everything in English. They came with nothing, tattered old coat or something, so they had help from the family who was here. But they really struggled, and in many ways, my grandmother wrote her memoirs. It's called Mina's Story, A Doctor's Memoir of the Holocaust. And it explains how she had, a great youth, but then the war cut it short, and this terrible sacrifice that she made in her life, really, coming to Canada and building herself up again. Luckily, they did manage to get their medical degrees. They worked hard. They saved. And because of that, made many opportunities possible for us. But my mother and father, they're also both doctors. So my mentors are actually at home in the family, and I've been very fortunate because of that. But when my mother was applying to McGill Medical School, back in the 50s and so forth, or 40s, McGill had quotas back in those days. Not these kinds of proactive quotas to increase diversity, but to keep diversity out. So there were quotas against Jews and against women. You couldn't have more than a certain number. So I think we've come in some ways a long way, but I think the immigrant experience continues and continues for waves of people who, I think 250,000 people immigrate to Canada every year. So there's still these stories continue to be a reality, and at St. Mary's they're trying to open a program for international medical graduates, but there's also tensions because you need the workforce, the capacity, the space, and so forth. And so while people want to support, there's also dissenting voices because they have to give the resources to be able to support this as well. So, but I think back to my grandparents' experience and so on. I mean, I think it's very important to support people and help them integrate, that they don't just end up as taxi drivers or as, working as porters in the hospital and so forth with their medical degrees. And young people should also have opportunities to join into the professions.
Thank you. We have a very interesting question from the floor. To the panelists, at the level of the practicing professionals, is there ongoing cultural competency training? And if not, is there anything planned in the works? Perhaps we can have one or two comments for that for 4 or 5 minutes, please.
I'm not a practicing professional, but I noticed that maybe there is. There are no four, as far as I've looked at most of the McGill curriculum, medical curriculum, the science curriculum, the law faculty curriculum. I think I know them all. There's very little room in most of these professional fields, very little room, any training beyond the narrow training that has to do with being a professional. Being an engineer requires you to do X number of courses in engineering to meet the standards of the board. Then you become a good engineer, but you don't know why that community doesn't want that bridge in that area. You don't understand that, the context in which you practice engineering. The same thing happens to some extent in law and in medicine, in those fields. To lesser extent in law, because the laws tend to go through a period of broader education. But I think in the professional faculties, I understand medicine primarily. There's, I think Adele is sitting there shaking her head saying, no, not in law. But to some extent, the law has changed a bit over the years. Yeah. But medicine and engineering, they tend to be a little more narrowly trained. So the answer is probably not.
There is, actually. We do have at the Faculty of Medicine ongoing, continuing medical education.
Medical education,
in the field of cultural competence, we do.
I mean, I must say that
it's optional,
but we do have it. It's available. I think that the people who are at the forefront of the field of cultural competency are actually the psychiatrists. And McGill, in particular, has a very, very strong group of academics and clinicians who work in this area. I think there's like an overlap between medical anthropology and what they call transcultural psychiatry, where they really look at how disease is experienced differently across different groups and so forth. And so some of the key players who really help to distinguish between what is disease, the physical nuts and bolts of it, versus the illness experience. There is a very famous anthropologist who works at Harvard Medical School, Arthur Kleinman, and he was among the first to write about this kind of issue. But we also have our own sort of homegrown fame at McGill University, and I would say that Lawrence Kiermaier, who works in psychiatry, he works with many different groups, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal and so forth, and he's also part of what they have now. They have this Canadian collaboration on the health of immigrants and refugees that have just come out with some guidelines, which are quite interesting in terms of how to approach and manage some of the issues, so not only the health issues in terms of infectious disease and whatnot, but also the social issues that are associated with this experience and so forth. So there are things, in fact, as part of our community-oriented primary care orientation to the community that the students and residents serve at St. Mary's, and Côte des Neiges is perhaps one of the most diverse, ethnically diverse, with over 50 nationalities of origin and dozens of languages and spoken and so forth. So to introduce them to the community at the beginning of each year, we have an orientation. We have invited community groups to come and speak. So Annie Quebec, who deals with mental health issues, and another one who talks about women's health issues and so forth. So they come and talk about how they provide support within the community. And we go on a walk and we go to the community and see what's out there, the languages, the different restaurants, the different groups that are there to support people in their communities. And I'm trying to invite my sister, actually. So my sister did social anthropology and was then sort of nudged by my parents to go into medicine and get a real job, according to my parents. And she became a psychiatrist, and she now works in areas of psychiatric trauma, so with people who come from other countries especially and have experienced traumatic events. And she's also part of an ACT team. So this is a team that tries to keep people with mental health problems in the community, supported by the community. And it's a team of doctor, nurse, social worker, etc., to sort of handle crises in the community and prevent people from needing to be hospitalized, which in itself is a traumatic experience. So she teaches cultural competency to the psychiatry residents, and that's very much a part of their training. But I agree with you, whoever posed the question, that we do have it to a certain extent at McGill, but there's always scope for developing this much more and really integrating it into the clinical training much, much more on an ongoing basis. And again, all this feedback and input is great, and it's something that I will take home with me and try to feed back into the Medical Curriculum Design Committee, which is actively working on making changes over the coming years. So,
great, thank you both for the question and the response. Yes, please.
My name is Nadia. I'm from Toronto. I came for this conference. First of all, I want to applaud all of you for the work that you do. I think it's really important. I just want to talk about patient responsibility and patient dependency on doctors. I'm 22 years old. I've had a series of physical pain in my body for the past 2 years, and I've been dependent on doctors for a really long time. And the doc—I'm of South Asian descent, and the doctor that I was seeing for a very long time, a family doctor, was a South Asian, and she didn't take me seriously. And I had to navigate through the medical system and also go through holistic people who do holistic practices, natural medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine. So I'm not interested in medicine at all, but like you, I'm really interested in health, and especially young people. I've been very lucky to have a dad who was really adamant on me tracking everything that happens to my body, having like a medical diary, which I try to keep. But I want to pose a question for people who are infiltrating these medical systems, but however, still not reaching out to their communities, but just did a medical degree for the sake of a medical degree, which is why I applaud everyone here, because there's a different angle to what you guys do. But I also want to ask you a question about patient dependency and a responsibility that we have as patients to be really aggressive in navigating through the medical system from the communities that you work in. And I'm an immigrant as well, so I should just put that out there. But I just wanted to see your perspective.
So the question, I presume, then, would be what aspect of patient dependency can you perhaps help us understand in terms of how that affects the community?
I guess my question is more in relation to, is it necessary for patients to educate themselves, which I think you have said, but how can these communities that you're speaking to, how can they educate themselves instead of being solely dependent? Because I didn't get to this point until my body was telling me that I have to get to this point, and I have to be aggressive, and I have to switch doctors, and I have to take this and this measure. So I'm wondering, with the communities that you work in, like you said, the Aboriginal community, for example, they can come and see you as a doctor, and you can be a really great doctor, and you really care about the community, but what about the patient's responsibility? And how do you encourage that when they sometimes live in bubbles, which I was living in for sure?
Perhaps Dr. Ferdinand, Dr. Anderman, you might have some quick comments on that, please.
It's a little different for children.
So I guess when I did my PhD at Oxford, I was actually looking at patient education, informed choice, risk communication for women with a family history of breast cancer. And outside of London and maybe Birmingham and some other large metropolises in the UK, it's really predominantly like 95% plus white, likely Protestant people who live in the UK. And so that was really the population that I was looking at. But I think despite that, I think in all peoples, a movement that has been occurring over the last, let's say, generation, where the doctor is no longer held to be, you know, just one below God, but is a person working in a system who is trying to help people with some specialized knowledge that they've gained. But a lot of decisions that are being made, we hope, are more and more based on some evidence, but there's always value choices that are also being made. And a certain decision that has to be made between the physician and the patient and negotiated. And I was just reviewing someone. We have cameras, and we're able to, with the consent, obviously, of the patient, watch the interview between our resident trainees and the patients. And they have something in the family medicine called FIFE, feelings, ideas, functioning, and expectations. And so we try to encourage the residents to talk to their patients about, you know, it's not just that they come in with a pain or, you know, I have this symptom or that symptom, but, you know,
what do they think this is? What are they worried that this might be? What are they, you know, how does it affect their everyday functioning? What are they expecting from you? What do they want you to do for them? Because I find that when it doesn't take so long to ask some of these questions and to really treat the person like a person and try to understand these things. When they do that, then they can much more easily negotiate with the patient together what would be the best plan of action. When people don't do this, then, you know, they say, okay, you have this, I'm going to give you this medication or that referral or just do nothing. And the person walks out feeling that they haven't had their needs met, which is why the fight fee is so important to engage people. And this is what we try to sort of instill in the residents. It's not an automatic thing that people do. But I think more and more people are becoming engaged and becoming empowered and educating themselves through the internet. You have to be cautious. The quality of information out there is very variable. Through physicians trying to help in the education process, which, you know, is a challenge to teach them how to communicate and so forth with their patients and how to have real shared decision-making. So there is a movement towards this, and I think it's an additional challenge to certain communities. So, for instance, with the issue of breast cancer screening and so forth, you know, already there's people who have to push their way through to be able to, you know, have the appointments and to get the kind of attention and care and education that they're looking for. But it's especially a problem when you have screening programs, let's say for breast or cervical cancer. Sometimes the groups who need them the most are the ones who don't actually go to the doctor and don't present. So from a public health standpoint, because I've done work on screening, I don't like the fact that we have what we call opportunistic screening, which means when the person presents, then they say, well, oh, is it time for your pap test? Is it time for your, you know, mammogram? What we really need is population-based screening. So we have a census of everybody in the population who is within the sort of age range who should be offered this. Have they received it? And if not, we have to go get them. We have to do outreach. So in the Cree community, what they did, because, I mean, there are no mammograms up north, comes to the boat issue that they raised, they actually have like a mammogram machine on wheels, sort of a little van that goes up to north to the communities. But you need to get the people to want to go, right? That's the whole cultural part. And so they did, you know, through very innovative ways, education and getting people mobilized, radio announcements. I mean, there's different ways that different communities get messages, health education messages. And they had 95% of the women who were eligible for the mammography to actually go and get their mammograms when the van came around to the community. And that was higher than any other region in all of Quebec. So sometimes small and spread out can be a challenge and very expensive for health services, but sometimes it can be a strength. And I think it's really just a matter of how one goes about these things and how one tackles these things. And I think it's also very important that there's informed choice and that people aren't feel pressured to do certain things, but really just get the information so that they can help choose for themselves. And so what you raise are some very important points, but I think it's not even specific to certain groups. I think society as a whole is changing the way medicine is, the way the interaction between patients and physicians. And yes, I think everyone needs more education to be able to judge for themselves what they want from the health system. So thank you.
Dr. Fernand, do you have your point? There's also another very interesting question. What are the top health concerns of Black Montrealers? Albeit broad, perhaps there might be some commentary on that.
I like to talk, but I've spoken for much. So I think the public health background is probably more appropriate to answer that question.
I don't know if your experience with the Batshaw and so forth.
Perhaps I can speak to the parts of that. So there are a variety of topics that health concerns are of specific interest to the Black population. Most notably are areas of disease such as diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol. It's
remarkable in that, although I'm not aware of the statistics for 2010, I can tell you as of 2008, the incidence of diabetes in the black population is approximately fivefold that of individuals who are not black. For issues of hypertension, black individuals are threefold more likely to have instances of hypertension before the age of 60. Just with regard to things like high cholesterol, the average black individual in Quebec is twofold more likely to have high cholesterol over their white or non-black counterpart. So just with regard to those three key areas of pathology or disease, you can see that black individuals tend to be more highly either predisposed or have a higher degree of prevalence with those diseases. Now, perhaps one of the key things to think about with regard to diabetes, high cholesterol, and hypertension is that with appropriate lifestyle changes and with appropriate education and appropriate support, these are critical diseases that can be treated and more progressively actually prevented. So it's incumbent, I think, not just on the community to make sure that we are aware of how these diseases affect us, but also it's incumbent upon the health system with regard to public health and institutions like McGill and the Faculty of Medicine to make sure that the resources and the education and the information is made readily available to the black community and to other communities who face similar health challenges. I think just a small point in summary is that a remarkable resource, albeit sometimes frustrating, is your local CLSC and your local hospital. We are in a system where resources are tight. We are in a system where waiting times are long. And unfortunately, we're in a system that has a lot of room for improvement. But the system still does have resources that can be taken advantage of. And it is incumbent upon us to make sure, as one of the participants of the conference mentioned, to be somewhat proactive and aggressive to challenge your health professional, to challenge your healthcare worker, to ask for these resources and ask for access to these resources if you feel that you are not receiving them. Do you have any comments, perhaps?
Just one comment on the importance of actually being aware that as members of the black community that we have to also be proactive in how we are treated when we suffer from these particular ailments. My own experience, I suffer from hypertension, and my own experience should be instructive. I went to see, when I discovered it, went to a doctor, prescribed medication, didn't work. Why didn't it work? It worked for everybody else we prescribed. Why didn't it work for you? But it turns out that, in fact, we do react differently to medication. You can't just prescribe it, you have to monitor people. So it's very important that not only are we aware, in fact, that of these diseases that affect us, but we also should be aware, in fact, that we must also seek out the best practices for treating you as an individual, for treating you. I'm not sure that the doctors are always sufficiently sensitive, sufficiently aware of that. And this is where our own proactive attempts to get more blacks involved in medical in becoming medical professionals, where they will perhaps have a little more sensitivity to the fact that we should be treated perhaps sometimes a little differently from others, from the general population. And that's a personal experience. In fact, it was my first reaction was pretty negative, the treatment I got initially.
I also just might add a little something. So in terms of
some conditions like hypertension, there's genetics, biology that might be the determinants of this. And this is regardless of where one might live or one's socioeconomic status and so forth. But it's also been shown that socioeconomic status is actually an important determinant of heart disease and many other conditions and even lifestyle factors like smoking and so forth that can underlie these conditions. So I think when we're thinking about illness, it's not only going to the doctor and getting treatment, and although that is clearly something that would be very important, but also trying to think about prevention. And I very much dislike how we blame the patient often and put this responsibility on the patient to do more to protect their health, when really these should be more policy level and societal level. What they say is we need to have healthy public policies and supportive environments that help people have the easy, have the healthy choices be the easy choices. So what are we doing in cafeterias? What are we doing in restaurants? The labeling of foods and so forth to help it be easy to get the healthy foods, to help it be easy to do the exercise, to have bike paths in Montreal, for instance, which is a new thing that they've started to do. So and trying to address really some of the community building aspects and helping people get jobs and education and so forth. So really taking the prevention angle on this and seeing what we can do as societies to mobilize and to change how things are structured at the foundation to be able to then impact these diseases later on, rather than just sending people to the door of the hospital and the clinic and so forth once they have them. So I think we have to have a wide view of how we really need a lot of structural changes to prevent diseases and to reduce these inequities as I mentioned at the beginning.
Great, thank you. We're going to take two last questions. Do we have a question from the floor?
Thank you to the panelists for sharing a lot of information this morning. My question is to expound a little bit on the question that you just referred to, and that is, what kind of resources are there available for regular citizens to collect information or statistics on black health issues in Montreal? I found in my personal research it's been very challenging to find specific information for black health issues in Canada. I have to check StatsCan under immigration and immigrants, but specifically for black people has been very hard. Unlike in the United States where they have like the CDC, which publishes like every year the top 10 black health issues, and then that information will be published in a magazine like Ebony, where everyone can read it. In Montreal, I'm going here, I'm trying to find this. And my question is I heard about an organization called, I think, the QBMA, Quebec.
Yes.
Do they collect and publish or share statistics on black health issues for black Montrealers? And then could it be published in some of our local newspapers, like Community Contact, and be put on CKUT or shared with us in conferences like this? Because I thought what you just shared was so clear and so plain, but very much unknown to a vast majority or a large number of just regular people. And to add to that, for instance, the points that you brought up on hypertension, diabetes, and high cholesterol, do we collect information on how our traditional diets, people from the African continent and Caribbean who are here in Montreal, the pros and cons and how it relates to those issues that you just brought up? My parents come from West Africa, and I was diagnosed with a very serious illness about 12, 15 years ago, lupus, and is perhaps some of the diets that I grew up with could have contributed or helped in my particular medical condition. That's me personally, but perhaps for other health issues that our people are dealing with, how does our traditional diets affect those issues? And are we collecting information on those issues in black Quebec and black Montreal specifically?
Thank you for a wonderful question. Do we have any comments on that?
With respect to QBMA, QBMA is not a research organization. We don't do a lot of research. Primarily an organization that foundation that actually promotes education rather than does basic research. No, so I don't think we have that information. But it's a good idea. I think it's a very good suggestion that we should actually look into that. So I will make that recommendation to the president that we should actually start collecting that information.
I mean, what you suggest is very true, and I think it's one of the big recommendations that comes out of that WHO Commission on Social Determinants. If you're going to look at gaps, you need to have the data. And we often have data, but it's what we call aggregated data. It's all lumped together. So, it's, you know, you just have an average. But if you want to know, are, you know, girls being more susceptible to certain conditions than boys, then you really need to have disaggregated by gender. And if you want to know if certain communities are having more health issues than other communities, well, then you have to have disaggregated data. I know I started working at Health Canada, and one of the first things that we're trying to tackle is how do we have data disaggregated for Aboriginal status so that we can have data on the communities that we're actually interested in looking at. And I think that one place that might have some data on this maybe is the Public Health Department of Montreal. They might be able to provide some information. Another alarming thing is what the Prime Minister is planning to do with our census. You know, they want to cut out so much from the census. How will we be able to disaggregate this data to be able to get any kind of information, you know, if you take out the question that asks about your origin, for instance, you know? So these are, I think, very important things and becoming also political things, you know, to keep the long form of the census is one important aspect. But also, when data exists, we need people to look at those specific groups and to be able to examine further. And I think that it's a very important point and the first step, really, in being able to examine the gaps that exist to be able to do something about it.
Thank you very much. Just to follow up on your point, your question, to the best of my knowledge, actually, that information is not being collected readily. Perhaps the Public Health Office of Montreal may have some resources that might speak to those points, but to the best of my knowledge, it's not. I also agree with you completely that it's critical. If we don't have that information and it's not readily available to the public, then the public cannot act. I think that when you look at organizations like the QBMA, part of the way that they facilitate the growth of the medical community, the black medical community, such that we can help to collect that information to speak to the public, is through their support. So indirectly, they facilitate providing a mechanism for that information to be provided. I think what's happened is that through time, we have come to the point where now there are organizations, perhaps hopefully like the MBMA, perhaps hopefully like SEED, that can, in a more structured and systematic manner, go into the communities, challenge the healthcare system, advocate for policy change, such that this type of information can be made readily collectible and then readily available. There are a number of resources, like you mentioned, CKUT or Community Contact or even just mainstream media, that I think the onus is there to make sure that this information reaches the public and can be provided in a way that's readily useful for their healthcare benefits. I think just the last question that we'll take for the panel.
Just one comment. I think there may be legal issues involved like that. I have a feeling that there's this Quebec restriction on release of non-medical information. I think Adele could probably speak to that. But there are some legal issues involved that may be a factor in our ability to collect this information. I don't know.
Perhaps.
We just had a couple other information leads if you were interested. And so not at the Montreal level, but at the Quebec level, the Institut National de Santé Publique de Québec, INSPQ, they've put out a portrait of health of the Quebec population divided by region, and so they might have some data that is divided up according to origin, for instance. And the other place to look also is the CIHI, the Canadian Institute for Health Information, I believe, and they have also put out health-related information reports, and they might have something also based on ethnicity or something like that that could be useful. So.
Great, thank you. So for the last question of the symposium, yes?
I happen to be a lawyer as well. Okay. And I'm not a specialist in this area, but if you're asking for statistical purposes, you know, what your race is, I don't think there's much of a right to privacy issue because you're not relieving anything medical. It's more for medical policy. So you can correct me if anybody has more up-to-date information.
Thank you for the comment.
In other words, you have, you know, it's a question of whether Quebec is committed to multiculturalism or not, but that's a big issue.
Thank you for the comment. So perhaps we'll do just for the last question, and we'll ask the panelists to speak about it individually for ideally no more than a minute. strictly a minute, thank you. Is what do you see by way of transformation and change for the future? I know it's a big question, but perhaps you can give us your one major point for what you see can be a key aspect for change, progress, transformation, specifically with regard to issues of socio-medical determinants in Black health.
I'm going to say three words: education, empowerment, and advocacy.
And so I think what I'm going to take home from today is the importance of increasing the cultural competency training as part of the curriculum. I think that that's something that's very important. And also, I think to have more engagement of the communities also in helping to fight the inequities, and hopefully people will join in on this challenge.
Yeah, I'd like to say a ditto to that last statement. What I'd like to see happen is for the community to be more militant about paying attention, knowing what's happening, and proposing changes, making sure that the community does not get ignored, and that things like, you know, how many people, what's the statistics on hypertension, diabetes, etc., is known. It's not something that you are searching the internet and all over the world for, and there's no place to find it. So what I'd like to see happen, Marcel, is that all of these issues that were raised here, for which we don't have answers, that they're collected and that we start to make sure that the next time you convene something like this, we have some answers for at least most of them.
Education. I think that that's the answer. I think we have to try to get more engaged in all aspects of education when it comes to the question of health. Medical, we have to get into the research. We have to actually be doing the research ourselves. We have not only doing the training, but we also have to be doing the research, education.
So I thank the panelists, and most importantly, I thank all of you for attending the conference and the symposium. Hopefully, the symposium has been, as I said at the beginning, stimulating and enriching, and ideally, it's provided you with some additional information that you can use individually and perhaps bring back to the community to speak with other people who weren't able to attend. We would encourage you to note that any of the panelists here presumably have their implicit authorization, can be contacted at their respective institutions and in their respective organizations should you require additional information. We also request that you please feel free to contact the MBMA and McGill University, specifically with regard to either the SEED office or, in other points, the admissions office, if you have any additional questions. So thank you very much, and I'll turn the floor over to the SEED organizer.
I would like to thank everyone for attending this session, and I'd especially like to thank the four panel members here for a very interesting and eye-opening session. On behalf of SEED, we would like to present you with a little token of our appreciation. I think I made a little bit of a mistake and gave them out earlier, so if you have one, I'm really sorry. Also, at this point in time, we would like to invite everyone for lunch just outside in the hallway. And thank you so much for participating. Oh, and fill out your evaluations. I always seem to forget something or the other.
Sure.